Hello, أهلا وسهلا, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1189, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the Israeli genocide and catastrophic situation in the Gaza Strip, and the increased Israeli colonizers and soldiers' attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank. During the second segment, we will listen to Francesca Albanese, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, presenting her most recent report titled Gaza Genocide, a Collective Crime, to the United Nations General Assembly on October 28, 2025. During the third segment, I will air some of the remarks delivered at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center's annual Unity and Friendship Gala held in Houston, Texas on October 25, 2025, highlighting Al-Quds, Jerusalem. I will air portions of the remarks delivered by Hamza Saada, Palestinian-American activist and content creator, portions of the remarks delivered by Dr. Waleed Gaber, president of the Arab American Cultural and Community Center, and I will air the remarks of the keynote speaker, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 755 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, Israel continued to break the ceasefire by killing and injuring Palestinians in airstrikes and drone attacks, and by sustaining the brutal siege on humanitarian aid and necessary equipment to feed people, rebuild infrastructure, and save lives. On October 28th, Israel claimed that Palestinian resistance forces killed an Israeli soldier in Rafah and alleged that the body of an Israeli captive transferred from Gaza by Hamas did not match one of the 13 to be handed over as part of the ceasefire. The Israeli government stated that it would resume wide-scale attacks, and that night, Israeli airstrikes killed at least 104 Palestinians, including 46 children, and injured more than 250. Journalist Mohammed Al-Jabari filmed Palestinians carrying the bodies of their loved ones, including many children wrapped in small white shrouds, to cemeteries on Wednesday morning. Hamas rejected Israel's claims, saying its armed wing had no connection to any attack on Israeli soldiers in Rafah, and called on the international mediators to take immediate action to rein Israel in. The political party called Israel's airstrikes, quote, an extension of a series of violations committed over the past few days, including attacks that resulted in deaths and injuries, and the continued closure of the Rafah crossing, which confirms the insistence on violating the terms of the agreement and attempting to sabotage it. Since the ceasefire took hold on October 10th, at least 211 Palestinians have been killed and more than 500 injured, according to Gaza's health ministry. The Gaza government media office tallied at least 125 violations by Israel of the ceasefire before Tuesday's attacks. Included in that number were at least 52 shooting operations directly targeting civilians, 9 incursions of its vehicles into residential neighborhoods, crossing the so-called yellow line, in addition to 55 shelling and targeting operations and 11 bombings of civilian buildings. 21 citizens were arrested in various areas of the Gaza Strip as well, the media office stated. On Monday, an Israeli drone strike near Khan Yunis in the south killed at least 2 Palestinians. In the aftermath of Tuesday's airstrikes, Gaza's civil defense spokesperson Mahmoud Bassal said that rescue workers were still trying to recover the dead and wounded from underneath massive amounts of rubble. Hospitals were overwhelmed with injured people, he said. What is happening in Gaza today is a disgrace to humanity and highlights the international community's complicity through its silence in these violations. The continuation of these crimes amidst the world's silence is an unforgivable moral and humanitarian failure, Mahmoud Basal said. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud stated on Wednesday that emergency medical staff at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City were reporting that their patients were coming in with severe shrapnel injuries from the Israeli missile strikes. Quote, the bombs and drone missiles fired by the Israeli military are packed with shrapnel, nails, and pieces of metal. And when they explode, that flies at very high speed and pierces through bodies. Many patients are bleeding internally. That's increasing the pressure on medical staff. And the fear did not end. There are still drones here in the skies of Gaza City. The kamikaze drones are hovering at a very dangerous low level, causing panic and fear, Hani Mahmoud said. On Wednesday, October 29th, two Palestinians were killed in the northern city of Beit Lahia after Israel claimed it targeted a weapons storage facility, in direct continuation of attacks even after it announced it was back to abiding by the ceasefire following the massacres on Tuesday. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated that, quote, Israel's genocide in Gaza has not ended. It has merely shifted into a quieter, less visible phase. By maintaining the siege and allowing intermittent attacks that kill civilians, Israel sustains a gradual process of extermination, while the world falsely claims the genocide has stopped. More Palestinian bodies were returned to Gaza this week by the Israeli military, many showing indications of torture and field executions, and many were returned unidentified. 41 bodies were buried with dignity in southern Gaza on Monday. The health ministry in Gaza announced that it was opening up a new civil office to work on identifying the remains of hundreds of Palestinians who have been returned to Gaza by Israel without any identifying information. The ministry also launched an online portal to help families identify their missing relatives. On Wednesday, approximately 100 bodies of Palestinians belonging to the Al-Shahebar family, who were massacred in November 2023 in the Sabra neighborhood of Gaza City, were finally recovered and buried by their surviving relatives and community nearly two full years after they were slaughtered. Euromed Human Rights Monitor had carried out initial documentation of the series of massacres. According to their research, the attacks, quote, which took place over 2 days, November 17th and 18th, 2023, saw the use of aircraft and drones to target residential buildings, civilians inside their homes, and those attempting to bury relatives killed in earlier attacks. As civil defense crews tried to recover thousands of Palestinians still missing and buried under the rubble caused by 2 years of Israel's ongoing assault, Israel maintains a total blockade on heavy machinery and recovery equipment. But it did allow in several heavy vehicles from Egypt in order to only locate and retrieve the bodies of the remaining Israeli captives. Reporter Issa Siam captured Egyptian heavy machinery operating in central Gaza on Monday. Drop Site News' Jeremy Scahill talked about the double standards in the context of whose bodies are deemed more important to recover on Democracy Now! Earlier this week.
There are believed to be roughly 13 or so bodies of Israeli captives left. The great Yemeni cartoonist Kamal Sharaf had a piece of art the other day that showed a camera snaked to a piece of construction equipment pummeling through the ground past dead Palestinian bodies to try to find one Israeli body. And, you know, everything that Israel has accused the Palestinians of, Israel does as a matter of doctrine. You know, the confession, you know, the accusation is the confession, and we've seen that for 2 years. Donald Trump said, what kind of sick people hold dead bodies? Israel, since 1967, has had a policy of holding the bodies of Palestinians. As of before the genocide, there were believed to be more than 720 Palestinian bodies being held in coolers and numbered graves by Israel. There may be as many as 1,500 Palestinian bodies held by Israel since October 7th. So estimates are more than 2,000 dead Palestinian bodies are being held by Israel right now. One Palestinian political prisoner, his body has been held since 1980.
Jeremy Scahill on Democracy Now! Earlier this week. Turning to the occupied West Bank, we continue our reporting on the escalating attacks by Jewish Israeli settlers and soldiers on Palestinians. My colleague Tamara Nassar reports that in the first 2 weeks of the olive harvest season, which began in October, the UN monitoring group OCHA documented more than 85 harvest-related settler attacks on Palestinians and their property across 50 towns and villages in the occupied West Bank. The following is from Tamara's article, Olive Harvest Season Marked with Assault by Jewish Settlers. More than 110 Palestinians have been injured, 50 of them by Jewish settlers and the rest by the military. Settler attacks during the harvest season have ranged from violent assaults on farmers, theft of olives and harvesting equipment, and cutting down or uprooting trees, to obstructing access to land, among other violent attacks, including burning cars belonging to Palestinian residents. In many incidents, Israeli soldiers accompany the extremist settlers, either standing idly by or actively assisting the attacking settlers, said Yesh Din, an Israeli group that monitors settler activity in the West Bank. Both settlers and soldiers, quote, have so far enjoyed complete impunity for attacks against Palestinians, even deadly ones, the United Nations Human Rights Office said on Monday. In the first week of October, settlers had already cut down some 300 trees, according to Yesh Din. The group said no arrests were made and shared pictures from the Palestinian villages of Kafr Kadum in the north and Sa'ir in the south. The number has grown at least tenfold since, with more than 300 trees and saplings, primarily olive, vandalized, OCHA reported. Tamara adds that these increasing attacks come on the heels of Israel's stated ambitions for further control, theft, and annexation of the West Bank. The UN Human Rights Office said that, quote, settler violence is escalating far beyond the olive harvest season, making life impossible for Palestinians in many communities across the occupied West Bank and leaving them with no genuine choice but to leave their homes. Even as Israeli politicians and lobbyists try to muzzle exposure of Jewish settler violence against Palestinians by calling it blood libel, settlers brag about the crimes they commit against Palestinians on their private communication channels. Quote, the offenders proudly count the number of Palestinians they've injured, the houses and vehicles they burned, and the damage caused to thousands of trees and other Palestinian property, Yesh Din reported. That's all from Tamara Nassar's recent article, Olive Harvest Season Marked with Assault by Jewish Settlers, on electronicintifada.net. Settlers stormed the village of Tuba in Masafer Yatta in the southern West Bank earlier this week. On Wednesday, Israeli settlers reportedly destroyed hundreds of ancient olive trees in the village of Karyut, south of Nablus, according to the Wafa news agency. Farmers said they were shocked to find their olive trees destroyed when they entered their lands in the western area of the village after obtaining a 2-day access permit from the Israeli army. The lands are located near the illegal colony of Eli, built on the lands of the villages of Karyut, Al-Sawiya, and Al-Luban Al-Shakia. Local sources noted that this is the second consecutive year that settlers have carried out similar attacks of destruction in the same area, Wafa reported. On Wednesday evening, Israeli settlers attacked the village of Burka, east of Ramallah, Wafa stated. Settlers attacked the outskirts of the village and attempted to storm it before being confronted by local residents. Israeli forces later stormed the village following the attack, Wafa added. Meanwhile, the Israeli army raided the village of Umm al-Khair in Masafer Yatta on Tuesday morning and handed residents a stack of demolition orders, the latest in a decades-long series of attacks and plans to completely destroy the Masafer Yatta villages and expand the nearby settlement colonies. Village resident Aid Hathaleen recorded this clip on Tuesday, showing the demolition orders.
Hello from Umm al-Khair, this is Eid. Umm al-Khair community today shocked by this large number of these demolition orders, which included everything standing here in Umm al-Khair, all structures which rebuilded and built before almost 15 years ago, And also it's include agriculture facilities, also the community center, also living houses, also stores, also kitchens. And we have these type of orders in hand. We have two type of orders. One of them is the final demolition order. This means we have 4 days to appeal in the Israeli court. And this one is a stop working order, which given to a new house.
We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Displacement Begins with a Scissors Cut by Isra Al-Sigali in Gaza. Isra writes, quote, "When the Israeli military ordered us to evacuate the north, I cut my hair. When I told my mother, Hadia, that I wanted to cut my hair, she didn't look at me. She didn't even pause from folding the clothes into the suitcase. Go ahead, cut it," she snapped. Her voice was sharp, clipped, like the scissors were about to be. My sister Besma stood behind me, gathering the long river of my hair in her fingers. It reached below my waist, a curtain I had carried for years. She combed slowly, carefully, tugging at knots with a patience that felt like grief. For months since the collapse of the last ceasefire in March, I had promised myself, if there was even the smallest chance the negotiations would succeed, I would keep my hair. Every night I opened Telegram, scrolling for news that might save it. Every morning, nothing. The teeth of the comb whispered through my hair. For a moment, I imagined we were still at home on just another day, my sister braiding my hair. But the smell of gunpowder and smoke and the half-filled bags in the corner of a room of my brother-in-law's uncle's house in Al Rimal, where many relatives had sought shelter, reminded me this was not a comforting routine, but a farewell. She braided tightly, her fingers moving as if she were binding memories into the strands. When she tied the end and laid the braid against my back, her hands lingered. She hesitated. "What a loss," she murmured. The scissors gleamed. "Cut it," I said. "I will not regret it." Snip. 60 centimeters fell. The braid slipped from my head into my sister's palm, and loose clippings curled on the floor like tiny black question marks. Days later, as we were preparing to leave, my other sister, Asma, leaned close. "They say hair holds memory. This braid is full of them. Your new hair will grow, but it won't remember." I lowered the braid into a thin plastic bag. In the mirror, I saw a stranger, the bare nape, the hollow expression. We kept packing in silence, shirts folded, papers tucked away, shoes shuffled into corners of the suitcase. When I finally zipped the bag, the braid lay buried inside, quiet, sealed, a piece of me smuggled into exile. On September 23rd, our company walked more than 25,000 steps. My sister has an app, or more than 5 hours to reach Deir al-Balah. The ceasefire was announced on October 9th. The day after, my family and I went back north to Al Rimal and the apartment we had rented there. Days later, I looked at myself in the mirror. My hair hadn't started to grow yet, and I felt regret. I had said I wouldn't, but I did. That braid had carried years of ordinary days, of laughter and sunlight, of the smell of home. I had cut it to survive, but survival had its own cost. My hair will grow again. Gaza will too, but neither of us will forget the sound of the scissors or the bombs. Those are excerpts from Displacement Begins with a Scissors Cut by Isra Al-Sigali, a writer and translator in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. In Gaza, volunteers with the Samir Project, a mutual aid organization, recently kicked off their new initiative called Let's Build It to rebuild areas in Gaza City and the north. They sang songs in honor of the homeland and cleared rubble by hand with shovels and with small tractors. A young boy says, quote, "We are happy today that you are opening up the streets. As you can see, the streets are closed and people are unable to go to their homes. We are happy that you brought a hardworking team. This makes us very happy, and it's a good thing that people can go back to their homes. We promise that we will rebuild. God willing, we'll rebuild it."
المجد وارض العزه بلدي الغاليه الحلوه غزه يا رب
بلدي ايوه يا غزه بلدي غزه يا
رب. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Francesca Albanese, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories occupied by Apartheid Israel since 1967, released a new report titled Gaza Genocide, a Collective Crime. This new 24-page report documents that the ongoing genocide in Gaza is a collective crime sustained by the complicity of influential third states that have enabled long-standing systemic violations of international law by Israel. Framed by colonial narratives that dehumanize the Palestinians, this live-streamed atrocity has been facilitated through third states' direct support, material aid, diplomatic protection, and in some cases, active participation. Let's listen to Francesca Albanese, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories occupied by Apartheid Israel since 1967, presenting her report, Gaza Genocide, a Collective Crime, to the United Nations General Assembly on October 28, 2025.
On day 751 of the genocide in Gaza, I begin by honoring the victims and survivors of all genocides, past and present, including the Native Americans, particularly the Lenape people, the original stewards of the land on which the UN headquarters now stands. People of conscience long for the day when the country built on the genocides of countless indigenous nations in what is now called the United States will atone for its past and embrace a multilateralism grounded in equality and mutual respect. I deeply regret not being able to present this report in person due to unlawful and spiteful sanctions imposed on me for fulfilling my UN mandate. And thank you for those have expressed solidarity to my persona and mandate. But this assembly should have already confronted this dangerous precedent. These measures constitute an assault on the UN itself, its independence, its integrity, its very soul. If left unchallenged, these sanctions will drive yet another nail into the coffin of the multilateral system. And yet, there is profound symbolism in the place from which I speak, South Africa, whose legacy reminds the world that freedom is indivisible. The chains on one are the chains on all. And as we gather, Gaza remains strangled, starved, shattered. Hundreds of thousands have been killed or injured. Thousands are missing, buried under the rubble, or disappeared into Israeli dungeons. And as the dust settles and the fire continues, survivors search for the remains of loved ones, while bodies long withheld by the Israeli army are returned bearing signs of torture and desecration, many in a state that makes them impossible to identify. In the West Bank, settler colonial expansion intensifies, Israeli forces raid, arrest, and kill, while violent settlers burn villages, uproot trees, seize more land, pogrom after pogrom. My report makes it clear. These horrors are neither sudden nor accidental. They are the culmination of decades of moral and political failure within a resilient colonial world order sustained by a global system of complicity. Through unlawful actions and deliberate omissions, too many states have harmed, funded, and shielded Israel's militarized apartheid, allowing its settler colonial enterprise to metastasize into genocide, the ultimate crime against the indigenous people of Palestine. And how did it happen? First, diplomacy. Diplomatic fora meant to preserve peace have been used to justify and advance this genocide, dehumanizing the Palestinians, legitimize Israel's false claim to be acting in self-defense, or vetoing ceasefires. Those who have dared to oppose it by using, for example, the international justice system like South Africa, Palestine, Nicaragua, or Norway before the International Court of Justice, or those who have engaged with International Criminal Court have come under heavy pressure. Second, military ties. Weapons, intelligence, and joint trainings have fed the genocidal machinery. The United States alone accounts for 2/3 of Israel's weapon imports. Dozens of other countries, though, continue training arms and surveillance devices that have been field tested on the Palestinians. Decision makers have thereby exposed themselves to possible accountability before both national and international courts. Third, trade. Over 2 years, Israel's exports soared to $474 billion, fueling its war economy. And despite 2 years of genocide, the European Union, quick to sanction Russia over Ukraine, remains Israel's main trade partner, including in dual-use goods deployable for military purposes. This trade and all related military agreements must be immediately suspended. And last but not least, the weaponization of aid. The unlawful Gaza blockade has gone largely unchallenged by states. And while attacks on UNRWA, the backbone of the UN humanitarian response in the region and in Gaza in particular, have been tolerated or repeated, the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has turned aid distribution into killing fields for starving civilians. While this has been dismantled now, this gruesome enterprise and those behind it must be held accountable. Excellencies and delegates, international law is clear. No state may aid or assist another committing international crimes. This is neither charity nor a matter of choice. It is binding upon you. It's a binding obligation, and violating it risks complicity. Therefore, states must secure a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, in ensuring full Israel's withdrawal from all occupied Palestinian territory and the dismantlement of the settlements. Second, suspend all military, trade, and diplomatic ties with Israel until it ends and remedies its genocide, unlawful occupation, and apartheid. And third, investigate and, where warranted, prosecute those potentially involved in these crimes, including those who served in the Israeli army during and profiteered from the genocide. This is how we begin to honor the memory of those killed. And if the Security Council is paralyzed, this assembly must act under Uniting for Peace with greater resolve than ever before. And this is how we also honor the dignity of those who survived. This is how we give full meaning to this august institution that has just turned 80, from the ruins of Gaza and from the hope of South Africa, through the resilience of Palestine, may a new multilateralism rise, not a facade, but a living framework of rights and dignity, not for the few, not of the few, but for the many. Thank you.
That was Francesca Albanese, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied by apartheid Israel since 1967, presenting her most recent report, Gaza Genocide, a Collective Crime, to the United Nations General Assembly on October 28, 2025. I have a link to the 24-page report posted on our website, arabvoices.net. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center in Houston, Texas, the fourth largest city in the United States, held its annual Unity and Friendship Gala under the theme Gathered in Spirit, United for Peace on October 25, 2025. This year's gala held special significance by paying tribute to and highlighting a city cherished in the hearts of Arabs around the world, Al-Quds, Jerusalem. The gala, which I attended, was amazing. It featured a photographs section displaying incredible photographs of Jerusalem. These photographs were taken by Hanan Awad and Mohammed Badarna, two Palestinian photographers whose work showcased the essence of Palestine and her people. Through their lens, they have captured the timeless beauty and spirit of Jerusalem. The gala was a landmark celebration, recognizing exceptional individuals whose contributions have profoundly impacted the community. This year's ACC honorees were Dr. Mahmoud Rabia, receiving the Outstanding Community Service Award, Dr. George Zabak, with the Lifetime Achievement Award, Lena Sabouni with the Influential Women Award, and Honesty Environmental Services with the Business Philanthropy Award. Congratulations to all the honorees. There were several remarks delivered at the gala, and I'm going to share some of them with you now. Let's begin with some of what Hamza Saada, Palestinian-American activist and content creator, who was the master of ceremony for the gala, had to say.
Welcome to this year's ACC Gala, a night where we can celebrate our heritage as Arab and unite together under one shared culture. It's almost surreal to say, but it has been two whole years since October 7th of 2023. The Palestinians of Gaza continue to be the subject of genocide and ethnic cleansing. On top of the tens of thousands of deaths in Palestine, the imperialist violence has reached our brothers and sisters in Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and we cannot forget what's happening in Sudan. Altogether, we've experienced loss beyond anything seen in our lifetimes. Before we start tonight's program, I'd like to ask everyone to join me for a moment of silence for all of the martyrs that we've lost. Thank you. I just want to say that it's gatherings like this that fills me with hope. When we all come together united in a just cause, there's nothing that we can't overcome. We actually have some children from Gaza with us tonight, with their families, and I hope that tonight they can feel some warmth from our community. Let's please give them a hand. They're in the back on the left. Tonight is the very essence of Palestinian Samud, the steadfastness, the resilience, the perseverance that defines our culture. Tonight, we're honoring the city of Al-Quds, Jerusalem. Despite being the heart of Palestine, it is a rare privilege for a Palestinian to even be able to set foot in the old city, to pray in Al-Aqsa, to visit the church. The Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have been denied this right to visit their own capital for decades, but they still maintain its focus in our national identity and struggle, and they still remain Samedin. In spite of the repression, Palestinians will always cherish the legacy of Al-Quds and remain attached to the city, refusing to give up their heritage. Even the Jerusalemites today continue to resist the occupation's efforts to erase their presence. East Jerusalem neighborhoods like Sheikh Jarrah refuse the ethnic cleansing imposed on them. The history of Jerusalem has been about resilience. An ancient city that has seen empires and occupiers come and go. The history of Jerusalem mirrors the Palestinian experience as they continue to resist injustice and occupation. Al-Quds is and will always be the heart of Palestine and the beacon of Palestinian identity and nationalism.
That was Hamza Saada, who was the MC for the ACC's annual gala. Let's listen next to portions of the remarks delivered by Dr. Waleed Gaber, president of the Arab American Cultural and Community Center.
Friends, since its inception in 1995, the Arab American Cultural and Community Center has been at the center of the Arab community. It has been the focus of its endeavors to build a home away from home for our families and to share our cultural heritage with other communities in this vibrant and diverse city of Houston. Our Arab heritage has and still connects us to communities from Africa, Asia, South America, and Europe through centuries of trade and shared religious and language ties. This is particularly important here in Houston, a city of immigrants from all these parts of the world who are standing together to preserve their identity, to enrich and shape a diverse and equitable community here in Houston. Friends and guests, I personally feel fortunate tonight to be standing here among you celebrating in Quds al-Sharif, Jerusalem, one of the world's greatest cities, a city that embodies who we are and represents how we had built this diverse society once and still hope to recreate it once again there and here. In the Arab world, as soon as you pass a renowned ancient city, as soon as you step into another one, at the heart of all this history and tradition stands the rose of all cities, Al-Quds al-Sharif, the honorable, the holy, a city that transcends all others. But alas, free people of the world, Al-Quds is now screaming out, calling for all those that love her to help restore her to its glorious past, when it was a place for those that love life, God, and all human beings, and one that does not discriminate between them. Until such day is upon us, let us keep reminding ourselves, our children, and all free people in the world that the rose of all cities is yearning for its true custodians, the Palestinian people. Dear guests, you all make me feel fortunate that I belong to this Arab community, a vibrant, strong, and creative community. Thank you all for what you do, and please keep doing more of it. I also feel fortunate that I can call the Palestinian people of Gaza my brothers. Gaza, that has etched its name with too much sacrifice, steadfastness, and amazing ingenuity in the history books, showing everyone what does it mean to be Samidun, steadfast, defending one's land and way of life against such shocking, shocking aggression and genocide. I'm also fortunate to call the Lebanese, the Yemenis, the Iranians, and all the free of people of the world brothers who would not tolerate injustice and aggression.
That was Dr. Waleed Gaber, president of the Arab American Cultural and Community Center. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib was a special guest at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center's annual Unity and Friendship Gala. Let's listen to her keynote speech delivered at the gala.
Of course, being the only Palestinian in Congress was not something I planned. I want you to know the community I was raised in literally is surrounded by pollution. Working class. My father came with only fourth grade education, my mother eighth grade education. We did not come from an educated family, a wealthy family. Both my parents came for barely nothing. My mom came from Palestine pregnant with me, literally 3 months pregnant with me. I tell people I was made in Palestine. But they came here with barely anything. So when I ran and we were in Southwest Detroit, And again, I was born and raised in the most beautiful blackest city in the country, 85% black city. Mashallah, it's beautiful. You know, every corner is a reminder of the fact that we, the people, have power to move institutions that weren't built for us. But I didn't run to be the first of anything. I never ever thought that I would be in Congress during a genocide of the Palestinian people. And I can tell you right now, it chips at my soul. I knew, but I wasn't exactly sure how incredibly dehumanizing and the racist tropes they use about the Palestinian people, which really seeps into the way they think of Muslims and Arab in general. I still remember when Congresswoman Cori Bush and I introduced the ceasefire resolution. Such a bad word. Shh. Remember? Ceasefire was a bad word. The Biden administration called us repugnant and disgraceful. Sometimes I literally, on the floor, if you've heard my speeches, I would literally say, if you need to close your eyes and pretend they're not Palestinian for you to believe they have a right to live, then close your eyes. Pretend they're a different faith, a different ethnicity. Then maybe you would care. I still remember in the height of resolutions after resolutions funding the bombs, the weapons, the war crimes, a New York Democrat standing up in caucus saying they're all guilty. But I was raised in Detroit. I was taught by community mothers who literally would tell my mom, Fatima, raise your voice, we can't hear you, because she was so scared all the time. I used to translate for my mom, I still do. All of us, you know this experience. I still remember being 11, 12 years old at Sears, and for the young people, that was a department store. We were at Sears, and you remember back then, they had the coupons you had to cut out. And I went to the cashier's desk with my mom, and my yama is telling me what to tell her, and the cashier's looking at me, the 11, 12-year-old. She needs to learn English. Well, you had to know my Siti Shama, alhamha. She was from Beit Hanina, if you know anything about women from Beit Hanina. And she literally looked at me and said that, and I said, excuse me, but I'm not translating what my mother, what you're saying to my mother. I'm only translating what my mother wants to say to you. She understands English. She speaks it. But people like you are the reason she doesn't feel safe. At that moment, my mother was so upset. She literally took the clothes, she puts it on the counter, and she does that, you know, that yumma pinch? I think it's an immigrant pinch. I don't know what it is. It's that pinch. He thinks nobody can see it. You know what I'm talking about. She pinches me, and she goes, آخر مرة منيجي عالسيرز هاي. ليش يمّا إنت الوحيدة بتسوينا مشاكل. She says to me, this is the last time we come to this Sears. How come? How come you're the only one that causes trouble? Because, mashallah, I'm the eldest of 14. I don't know if people know that. I have seven, mashallah, say mashallah, I didn't say what. Okay, I have seven younger brothers, six younger sisters. I literally tell people we are a voting block in Detroit. But even in that moment, she goes, Damon Hankin, my mom always, it wasn't that time. Leshia mahalas bin nash mashakel. How many of you have heard a Palestinian family in the air? Bin nash mashakel. Come on, you heard it. Bin nash mashakel. We don't want trouble. Shh, no trouble. Do you know, growing up, I used to think, God, why is my mom so weak? Wallah, I can't tell you guys how much I used to get so angry with her because she didn't want to fight. It took me at 19 years old to realize, and I was in full esteem, watching my mother go through a checkpoint with my Siti, shrinking, no eye contact, barely breathing. Literally at that moment, I realized that's how my mom survived. Shh. No eye contact, do not breathe. Be invisible. But it took that moment for me to see the physical literally shrinking to notice. We thought, if we come here, we educate our children. I'm the first in my family to get high school diploma. College, you heard the stories. Come here, we'll educate our children, we'll make money, we'll build businesses, we'll become doctors, engineers, teachers. And that will protect us. You know that's what we thought. It didn't work. It's never gonna work. What's gonna work is us creating our own institutions, literally that push from the outside in. It was community mothers that would tell me all the time, Rashida, we're never gonna get Water is a Human Right Act passed from members of Congress, because they didn't wake up one day and say, wow, the Civil Rights Act was a great idea. It's when people boycotted, they marched, they pushed from the outside in that we got it, and it's not even perfect. You think the President of the United States woke up one day and said, wow, the right to organize unions, which I got straight teeth because of the UAW. Literally, got insurance because of them. Because they didn't offer dental and visual. I mean, they still don't offer hearing aids and everything in public, literally healthcare. You guys know this. But it was the people from the outside in moving an institution that wasn't built to do what is right until we make them do it. So build institutions. It's not only ACC, but so many others. It doesn't have to be one, it can be many. I know that we can organize literally block that voting block that cannot ignore. And I know it won't work right away. It'll be brick by brick. But I've seen it done in our country over and over again, where the people on the outside organize and push them on the inside. MashaAllah. Everywhere I go in town halls, literally my colleagues send me videos as if I'm related to every protester out there. They're getting asked at town halls about cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, their Social Security, and genocide. People that do not share my faith or ethnicity are asking their members of Congress, why are we funding that? Why are we supporting that? Look at it. Watch. You might not be seeing it, but I see it because my colleagues come back from these long like breaks in their district having town halls. Literally, one of my colleagues in the Midwest said a farmer in Wisconsin got up and said, I don't want us to fund that anymore. It's when we do that. We have no other choice. The political establishments and parties have failed us. I watched over and over again, literally them pressing the button with no hesitation. My face turning red just watching again, no hesitation, sending more bombs and more weapons while our neighborhoods still don't have clean drinking water, and we're seeing poverty increase in so many of our communities. You see them for $40 billion for Argentina, boom. I think they just now sent another $12 billion to the government of Israel to commit more war crimes, boom. They show up with the money like this. What many of my colleagues continue to not realize is the American people are not with them on this. They're not. Polling is showing 77% of Democrats over the age of 65 said that Israel is committing a genocide. Not only that, 75% of them support ending the annual weapons funding, including 82% of Democrats over the age of 65 years old. So it's not only a generational issue, it's hardcore numbers that are coming back showing the American people are not with them. Yet my colleagues will ask me, well, what would you do in my place, Rashida? I mean, God, you know, because they come and try to justify their votes to me. I said, whoa, I don't live in your district. What's your district thing? What do you mean? I said, well, aren't you gonna poll them? What do you mean? I said, you poll on immigration, on environmental issues, on all these other issues, healthcare, poll them on funding genocide. But I know there's too many warmongers in Congress right now, many of which drool over defense contractors. Do you know why? Because they own stock in Raytheon and war manufacturing. So every time they press the button, they personally benefit from death financially. I introduced a bill to ban it, and they know I'm exposing them for exactly what they're doing. It's end war, profiting. I know we must continue to demand a complete arms embargo for all weapons to the Israeli government, no matter what they label it. Weapons are weapons, Ya Jamaa. Either you want to end the funding of the genocide or you don't. You can't sponsor Black the Bombs Act. And I'm telling you this because some of you are accepting crumbs. Don't. You can go ahead and co-sponsor Black the Bombs Act, yet you vote for literally more funding for the same country that is committing the genocide. You can't sign letters expressing concern over the forced starvation while enabling the same Israeli government committing the war crime of using access to food as a weapon of war. You can't boycott, this is a true story. You can't boycott Netanyahu's speech in Congress, yet meet with him later, literally weeks later, in Israel, and spread racist rhetoric and lies that the government is that is literally rooted in anti-Palestinian racism and Islamophobia. I say this because my colleagues have done this to you all. It's like an abusive relationship. I hear them say Palestinian statehood, a little late, but they fund, they sign letters saying Palestinian statehood. They just did this. And the same guy leading the letter is literally still funding the same government that doesn't support statehood and literally passed laws in the Knesset that forbids statehood. You can't support both. Colleagues will constantly tweet about their concern, and it makes us feel good. Oh, they see us. But they don't use the power of their vote to express real opposition. Again, I'm saying this to you all because this is exactly what's happening, and I feel like we're still accepting crumbs. We're seeing unprecedented resistance, though. I told one of my colleagues, you know, in 10 years, many of you are going to claim you were against it. I don't know if you've heard the quote from Omar al-Kakkad. I don't know. It's a beautiful quote where he says, quote, one day when it's safe, when there's no personal downside to calling it a thing what it is, when it's too late to hold anyone accountable, everyone will have always been against it. You know this, right? Attacking me for saying ceasefire, now they're all saying ceasefire. Attacking us for saying genocide, and now some of them are saying genocide. But at the end, they go up and they still vote for it. But I'll tell you what I'm inspired the most by is the countless videos I see of ordinary people not only standing up for Palestinian humanity, but also putting themselves on the line around ICE watches and mutual aid organizations, and they're springing, mashallah, all across the country. ACC should be asking what they can do to help. I learned from a Black pastor that our country is not divided, we are disconnected. And sometimes I feel like our Arab community disconnects from other movements because B'nash Mashakil. Why? Immigrant neighbors deserve civil rights because when you attack that civil rights of that immigrant, those are our civil rights, trust me. So I know we're standing in a crossroads of American history. We are going to take our country back, I feel it. It will shift. I want us to be at the front line of that. I don't want us to be in the background. We're gonna win because they don't have any other option. Yani, we're not going anywhere. We're not. We're gonna be right here. If anything, our movement is growing and growing. I'll leave you with a story. You know, my yumma, oof, she is a character. She keeps me humble. And all of us have a yumma. I know you all know that yumma who literally calls me at 10 o'clock, says, Wanich, why are you, I said, yumma, why are you calling me? Call my other sisters. I'm a congresswoman. I have meetings and things. Mahu ashara fil-lail, yumma, rawhi. She's like, literally, go home. It's 10 o'clock at night. But do you know I had to call her because every time, I don't care if it's on one fair wage, fighting for health care, you know, I'm over there causing the good trouble. So I had to call her because my sister said you should call her, Rashida, because you know Yumma, she's going to worry about you. And I said, okay. So I called her and I said, Yumma, هذا الحمار جاي. She goes, Anu Minhim. She goes, which one is coming? I said, Netanyahu. They invited him. Both Democrats, Republicans signed a letter inviting him to address Congress. She was shocked. She says, nah, no. Leshiyama, why? Literally, my mom's like, why? I said, I don't know, Yama. She goes, I was literally waiting for her to tell me, Yama, B'nash M'shaken. I was literally waiting for her to say it. Do you guys know what she said? Well, I was waiting for it and I was prepared. I don't yell at her anymore. I don't get angry because I know she grew up in apartheid. She grew up like literally, be invisible, you'll be safe. She goes, Shubajistilbisi. She goes, what are you gonna wear? And I said, I don't know, Yama, what should I wear? She goes, Anabajib Lichthob. So she goes and gets me. She goes and gets me a thob. You guys ever see those thobs with the Palestinian flag? And it's like flags up and down. It was too much, Jamaa. So I only wore the belt. But even afterwards, wallahi, she called me. I said, Shuftini, Yama? She goes, yeah. Shahu Talalaj. I said, Yama, three times. Three times he looked at me. She goes, ah, Hatiti Fuja. I said, yeah, Yama. She goes, good. She goes, good. She goes, I'm proud of you. Yeah. So make good trouble. Halas. We can't be invisible, Ya Jamaa. We can feed the world. We can do all these beautiful things. But please give space to a little bit more mashakil, because we have to continue to shame them for the hypocrisy of the fact that majority of a country is with us to end this genocide, and yet the institutions are not moving. Thank you so much, ACC. Thank you.
That was Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib delivering the keynote speech at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center's annual Unity and Friendship Gala, held in Houston, Texas on October 25, 2025. Congratulations to the ACC and all the hard-working volunteers who made it possible for a very successful gala. For more information about the ACC, visit www.acchouston.org. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.